This is a recording of the audit hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on November 4, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Now begin the audit hearing for the Tennessee Democratic Party, and it's comment here in terms of we have Mr. Joe Sandler and Neil Reif there representing the Sandler, Reif, and Young representing the Tennessee Democratic Party. It's welcome to have you here. I would want to remark that unexpectedly, the Vice Chairman Peterson is unable to be with us for this afternoon session, so we're down to five commissioners. Hopefully, that's enough. And we'll proceed. We have Tommy Duncan on my far right, who's with the Office of General Counsel, and we have Larry Calvert, who's with our Office of General Counsel, Alec Palmer, who's our Acting Staff Director, and Joe Young of our Audit Division. And this audit hearing marks our very first hearing under the Commission's new procedures, which were published in the Federal Register on July 10th of this year and went into effect on July 27th. The audit hearing program was instituted as a result of public hearings on enforcement procedures that took place in January. Many commenters at the hearing praised the FEC's program for holding probable cause hearings during the enforcement process, and some commenters requested that a similar procedure be adopted with respect to commission processes, including audits. Under the new pilot program for audit hearings, which the Commission will evaluate after 1 year to consider whether it should be made permanent, political committees may request a hearing before the Commission prior to the Commissioner's adoption of a final audit report. If two or more Commissioners approve such a request, the committee will have the opportunity to present oral arguments to the Commission directly, and the Commissioners may ask relevant questions. Hearings are voluntary, and the Commission will draw no inference based upon a committee's request for or waiver of such a hearing. On August 25, 2009, the Audit and Division sent a copy of its draft final audit report to the committee, as well as a copy of the relevant legal analysis. By letter dated September 14th, counsel requested a hearing on behalf of the committee, and on October 2nd, the Commission granted the request. The counsel has stated that counsel will address the issues described in Finding 1, which is referenced in the report as non-allocable federal election activity disclosed on Schedule H-6. That finding has three sections: polls, phone banks, and campaign rallies. Counsel has advised counsel wishes to address the polls and campaign rallies issues. With respect to the polls, the committee disputes the conclusion that the polls should have been paid for with solely federal funds. With respect to the campaign rallies, the committee contends that the invoices were mistakenly addressed to the Harold Ford campaign and that the rallies were actually sponsored by the party and were generic in nature. Counsel, for today's hearing, you may make a brief opening statement. To be consistent with the way we've been conducting our recent probable cause hearings, you may have up to 15 minutes for your opening statement. Following your presentation, the commissioners, general counsel, and staff director and audit director will have the opportunity to ask questions. The policy allows for the commissioners to ask questions designed to elicit clarification of the Office of General Counsel or the Office of the Staff Director. At the end of today's hearing, you will have an opportunity to make a closing statement. Counsel, we're ready to proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to our experimental procedure here.
Oh, we appreciate being the first.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, thank you for the opportunity to appear today on behalf of the Tennessee Democratic Party. We are here today to have what we expect to be a very brief presentation and hearing regarding a couple of fine points that were areas of concern to us with regards to the draft final audit report. Let me begin by saying that, regardless of the outcome of the issues presented today, the Tennessee Democratic Party is likely not subject to any enforcement actions arising from this audit because of unused allocation of non-federal funds, as well as unused remaining coordinated expenditure authority. Therefore, we have requested this hearing only to ensure that the final audit report properly reflects the facts presented in the audit and that the questions of law are properly presented to those who may read and rely upon this audit report. The first and primary issue that we would like to address is whether survey polls that were questioned by the Audit Division were in fact subject to regulation as federal election activities. First, no information from the poll was posted back to the party's voter file. Therefore, it would not qualify as voter identification activity. Second, a legitimate survey poll with a limited number of respondents surely should not be covered under the rules for regarding Type 3 federal election activity, since the purpose of these surveys is to test messaging for future activities and are not and cannot be effectively used as a tool in and of themselves to affect the votes of the limited number of persons contacted by any pollster. The second issue that we would like to point out is the cursory dismissal by the draft audit report of representations made by the committee regarding certain committee invoices that misidentified the invoicing committee as Harold Ford for U.S. Senate. These invoices represented a small percentage of invoices received by the committee, and it has been our experience that vendors commonly fail to, in their own minds, to properly distinguish between a campaign and their party committees. During the preparation of the committee's response to the interim audit report, the committee had already been notified that their response to this question would not affect any exposure that they may have regarding enforcement. However, the committee was adamant that the invoices were misdirected and wanted the final record to reflect that. To be sure, there would have been no reason or motivation for the committee to misrepresent the status of these invoices. I would only request that you take that into consideration when you weigh the representations made by the committee. Although the committee disclosed its rally costs as federal election activities, you may also wish to address whether the committee was required to do so. The evidence before us suggests that the rallies did not include federal candidates and were generic in nature. However, it is not clear under the Commission's regulations in place during the 2000 election cycle as to whether these rallies met the definition of federal election activity. Thank you for the consideration of these issues, and we'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Council. Any questions again with the commissioners? The Office of General Counsel, Commissioner McGann.
The polls, I see in the audit report they're talking about it was split between federal and Levin. Is that right? Seems odd.
I believe that's how they actually disclosed it. I believe we acknowledge we disclosed an error, that we actually moved them to Schedule H-4.
Oh, okay.
But when we amended the reports, we moved them.
So the Levin issue was
yes,
at the beginning of the
yes, they were initially disclosed that way, but they were those reports were amended, and I think we represented that in our response to the interim audit report.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit more about the rallies?
Sure. I have pretty limited knowledge of the rallies themselves, but the representations that were made to me by...
Probably have more knowledge than I have about
yeah.
them.
The representations that were made to me by our client is that they were purely designed to be generic, that they did not mention candidates, and that candidates did not appear at the rallies. We did not spend a lot of time doing fact-finding during our response to the audit report on this, but that's my understanding. If there's any additional facts that you might want to ask about that, that's my understanding.
Did you have further questions?
Not at this time.
I just wasn't sure. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you flesh out the FEA argument for me? Type 3 FEA...
This regarding the polls? Which regarding
the polls.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. A public communication that refers to a clearly identified candidate for federal office, regardless of whether a candidate for state or local office also mentioned or identified, and that promotes or supports a candidate for that office or attacks or opposes a candidate for that office, regardless of whether the communication expressly advocates a vote for or against a candidate. So, you know, you talked about the number of recipients. Is it the number of recipients? And if so, where does that come from? Where does that come into the regulatory or statutory regime? Is it the content of the poll? Do you think that nothing in that poll promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes a candidate, or that the combination of information that kind of goes in both directions negates the PASO? Flesh it out for me.
Essentially, Commissioner, it's not logical to regard a poll as a public communication within the meaning of the Commission's regulations. Public communication, the idea is that it's some form of general political advertising. It's intended to communicate with voters for the purpose of some way of, you know, affecting their vote, regardless of what, whether it's PASO, express advocacy. The purpose of a survey is not to persuade voters to do anything. It's simply to gather information to create a statistically reliable picture of what the electorate is thinking. And consequently, it just logically should not, cannot be regarded, does not fall within the meaning of the term public communication in the Commission's regulations.
Because it's not advertising.
It's not, it's not inherently a, right, a form of public
advertising
or voter contact for the purpose of persuading voters.
I understand the conceptual argument. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, I'm trying to tie it back to the words of the statute. And it seems to me that it goes back to whether this is advertising, or is there more to it than that?
Right. The words of the statute and the words of the regulation, it's clearly not any of the enumerated forms of public communication, and it is not and has never been regarded by anybody in the in the industry as being a form of general public political advertising.
And it's not a telephone bank?
No, telephone bank is understood to mean a telephone bank for the purpose of communicating with voters to persuade them to support a candidate, to get out the vote, to take some other action.
Commissioner Weintraub, are you? Okay, sorry. If you have a poll that is comprised in part of some fairly strong advocacy, when do you start to change the character of a poll to some kind of a public communication that's designed to persuade the voters? I look at the questions that were asked, and there's some there that are certainly appear to be advocacy to me. So I just wonder.
It's got to be.
You could say the overall purpose is, but that gets us into the intent a little bit. What about the overall effect?
Well, I think it's relatively easy to distinguish a legitimate survey poll from a so-called push poll, which is essentially a telephone bank and advocacy exercise. In the first instance, by virtue of the number of a person surveyed. I mean, it's a difference between a statistical sample and an actual universe of voters that would have some meaningful impact on the electorate. If you're talking to 300, 400, 600, 800 people to do a statewide survey, that's what's normally regarded as a, you know, typical statistical sample for a poll that gives you a result within a margin of error, 3 or 4 points, and it's not useful in any way for persuading the electorate and affecting the outcome of the election.
So it's the number, not the content of the message?
It could be
expressed advocacy all the way through, and as long as it was just less than 1,000 or around 500, it's okay?
I think you would have to take it in context.
Because 500 is not an...
I think you would have to take it in context if you were talking about a race with less voters. And, of course, when you're talking about federal elections, you generally have, you know, there's no election where you have less than several hundred thousand registered voters, unless you're in a small state. Tennessee had, you know, hundreds of thousands of registered voters. I think 1,000 people were polled. Another fact you could take into account would be the number of questions posed. As you see, these polls have several questions. A push poll would not, you know, it would never be this long. A push poll, an advocacy poll, would be something you would get your point across and get out of the conversation. Where you're talking usually about 3 to 4 questions in a push-poll type of situation. I don't have exactly the number of questions in these polls, but as you can see, these polls had, you know, 30 to 40 questions, if not more. So I think that would be another important factor to take into account.
But as I read a couple of these questions, by the time you warm somebody up to the questions, you really have some fairly potent comments about character and competence and that kind of thing. And it's like saying... did you hear so-and-so did this, and he did that, and he did that, all of which are either immoral or illegal, and say, would that affect your vote? And that's kind of the way some of these things seem to read. I'd say maybe 10 or 11 of them at least, maybe a few more than that.
Well, again, it's in a close case, obviously, it could be a question for expert testimony or the like, but the fact is that it's common that, and this is not a close case, it's common that messages are tested in the way you describe, and if it was 3, 4, 5, 7 questions, and that's all it was, that were basically, did you hear that the candidate did such and such, it would be pretty indicative of a push poll. This is clear. Any pollster on either side of the aisle or in from the commercial marketing advertising survey research industry would easily identify this as a legitimate survey poll and not a so-called push poll.
Commissioner McGinn.
I don't want to take up too much time on the polls because there was a matter that the commission already considered regarding essentially this issue, right? The council had recommended probable cause against the DCCC on, to me, the same issue. Our polls, public communications, and that sort of thing. And the commission didn't adopt the position that they were. So my sense is this audit had already been moving in the audit process. And to me, this... the poll issue's already been decided. However, I hear the chairman's questions, and it is a concern that I think we all share. But my sense is that is the nature of polling. You're always going to test a hard message in a real poll. So if you read it that way, it's always going to seem to be attacking somebody or promoting somebody or that kind of thing. In your experience, isn't there a kernel of truth in that it certainly could be read that way? But on the other hand, a poll always does that, and polls are distinguished from, if your client is going to go after a candidate, they know how to do it, and they're not going to do it to n equals 600 people, right?
Right.
So exactly. Could you maybe express a little bit more about how polls work?
Right. For the purpose of a so-called push poll, which is actually an advocacy exercise, would be directed to far more people because the purpose is not to obtain information from a sample of people, but to actually influence the electorate, and therefore you have to. It would be directed at a substantial or meaningful portion of the electorate. It would never be 1,000 people in a statewide race in a state like Tennessee. And it's also the fact, as the chairman pointed out, this is just a fraction, maybe 20% of the questions in a 30 or 40 question poll were message test questions that could be. Seem to have some kind of persuasive value if they were aimed at a very large segment of the electorate and the poll was limited to questions.
You're
of
testing
that nature.
The negative message, right? So the question is going to be, to use a phrase that we've all used, the shorthand of ripping the bark off the tree, right? I mean, it's going to be a very harsh test because that's the only way you're going to get the statistically significant answer. If you ask about how do you feel about somebody, that's not really going to be statistically significant. And I raise this because we just had an election yesterday, and I always like to sort of watch the news and look at the polling numbers and all these generics that people come out with. And in New Jersey, the third-party candidate was consistently polling double digits. But if you actually look at the questions of those polls, it was a generic, who do you support? Polls that had him in single digits asked the question, what if you knew this about this person, or what if you thought that the other candidate would win if you voted? And once you tested it down, you realized he wasn't polling double digits. And then when the polls closed, you realized the polls with the tougher questions were a lot closer to what people actually voted on election day. Is that consistent with your experience?
It is consistent. Obviously, different pollsters have very different approaches to these matters, but it's commonplace in the industry to test messages by asking the respondent, have you heard so and so about this candidate or about this person? And if you knew XYZ, would it make you more or less likely to vote for him or her? That is a common way to test a message for the purpose of determining whether, if that message is used in public communications, subsequently used in public communications, what the impact would be on the electorate.
So if a poll ends up, if a poll is FEA, because that, even though every poll tests a hard message, somehow that passes, Do you think Congress would have been a little more specific that they were trying to regulate polls that way? I mean, they are, as the McConnell Court noted, the sort of proverbial experts in the field, and it would seem odd that, given that they all do polls, that they wouldn't have been a little more specific. And I think I'm getting at sort of Commissioner Weintraub, the gist of her question, with let's tie this a little more to the statute. Statute cover polls this way, or doesn't it?
I mean, one of the issues is the one you alluded to, that the commission dealt with in the context of a MUR, which is disclaimers. I think that you're right that experienced members of Congress who've been through many cycles and with polling would be surprised to learn that a poll, which are, you know, typically has to be done identified as being done by a neutral organization, would have to carry a disclaimer. So I don't think it was assumed, although I'm not aware of any specific legislative history on this, that it doesn't make sense to think that members assumed that polls would be a form of public communications as defined in the statute.
Could the absence of such legislative history be significant? It seemed like there was a lot of specific talk about negative ads and soft money in federal elections, but conspicuously absent is discussion about polls. There was discussion about push polls, negative phone calls, that kind of thing. New Hampshire primaries had some of that. South Carolina primaries had some of that in 2000. Some of the sponsors didn't like that. There's a lot of talk about that. But polls seem to never come up.
Well, I'll just say that over the last 7 years, we have found many issues that we've had to address under the BCRA that no one thought of at the time they passed, considered, and wrote the legislation. So it's not, you know, surprising that we'd be here today talking about something that there's no legislative history on.
Right, but polls are so central to how we do campaigns today. You think if Congress wanted to reach out and touch them, they would have known, they would have actually mentioned it.
You would think so.
Because they're not the same as billboards and other public political advertising.
Based upon our understanding of what they intended to do in the Federal Election Activity Type 3 provision, I would agree with that.
When you do independent expenditure reports, and I should limit it to just the client you're currently representing, but if you want to go beyond, that's certainly acceptable. Some committees, and I don't think, some committees report polls as part of their independent expenditures. Others do not, because if they were public communications, they'd have to report them as an IE.
Absolutely.
Right. So it seems if none of the parties are reporting polling costs, at least the ones you represent, are they all breaking the law?
I guess if you take the statute literally, it's a possibility. So again, exactly. And I can say that if a poll lacks express advocacy, unless it was intended to expressly advocate the election of a candidate and that was the purpose of the poll, then we would not report it that way.
But if it's a poll, it's not going to expressly advocate.
But it may intend
a
question.
It's more or less likely to vote, and but that's not express advocacy. Right,
you might use an express advocacy.
Well, a magic word may be in there somewhere,
right.
but you've got to read the poll as
sure.
a poll.
You could say, would you be more less likely to vote for this person if we said John Smith stands for this? Vote for John Smith. So you could have express advocacy within the context of testing a message. So it's possible. I actually would want just a moment to point out one other aspect of this poll which we haven't described. There, and just in terms of the facts of this case, there are several, if you look at the poll, self-critical questions in the poll as well. They're not just testing questions against the opponent of Hal Ford, but there are many things in this. There were many questions in this poll that expose and test things that were negative against Harold Ford himself, and that just lends to the legitimacy of this as a poll and not as any kind of push poll or attempt at advocacy.
Just a couple more questions. I'm going to move to the rallies a little bit, and I have. As I understand the issue, there are invoices that are addressed to the candidate, the campaign, and your position is that was a mistake.
Correct.
And it was really a generic rally, and the invoice should have been.
That's correct.
You know, readdressed. I have some sympathy for that. I remember years ago working for a state party, and no matter how many times I told the landlord the invoice is not to go to Dole for President, they insisted on writing it to Dole for President, even though it was a state party headquarters. Now the statute of limitations has passed, so I can say that, but even if it hadn't passed, it still wouldn't be illegal, because it seems folks tend to always want to put the invoice to the person. Now that's just my gut reaction. Is there any additional information that's actually of a factual nature in this case as to why the invoice was addressed?
I will actually give us a little flavor. If you notice, I think, and I haven't sat down and looked at that carefully, but most of the invoices were from the Memphis area. And it's my understanding that most of these invoices were from minority businesses. And it's palpable that the excitement, especially in the Memphis area, where Howard Ford was from, that people equated in their own minds, vendors especially, that they're one and the same. And it was actually, it's been expressed to me by the staff of the state party that this was a frustrating thing for them because they would kept trying to correct this. But in their own minds, people in Tennessee, and that's exactly why generic rallies work, because in the minds of the voters, vote for the Democratic Party means vote for their
Democrats
their
on the ticket.
African-American candidates.
That's the point of a party.
My understanding is that, and again, this is a very small proportion of all of the invoices received for these activities. That's really what was, they believe, causing this misdirection.
So your sense is your client did attempt to correct it, but consistent with my experience, folks continue to put their candidate of choice as the one that they were billing, because my assumption is people who are not steeped in the nuances cannot possibly understand why it even matters who the invoice is.
That's my understanding.
Okay. One final question. Footnote 3 of your response, where you talk about things the commission may want to consider with vote drives and generic rallies and that kind of thing. Although I don't think it's an issue we need to decide today, it may be worth, if others would indulge me, a few minutes on elaborating on that, because I'm always looking for potential areas that may crop up in the future, areas of uncertainty, because the last thing you need is a state or local party not sure if they could have a rally, and then how they could pay for the rally and how they report the rally. They ought to be able to have a rally, and the law should be. So your footnote seems to suggest that there's more work that we could do here at the commission.
That's correct, and I'll admit that at the time we prepared the report, the response to the interim audit report, we had chosen not, because again, for the reason that we, as I said, we just didn't have any exposure with respect to the overuse of Levin funds, non-federal funds, to challenge our initial, because we initially reported it as Levin activity. So considering we had so much to do, we didn't pick that battle at the time. I was actually, my interest was piqued in the issue when I read the memorandum of the General Counsel's office in response to the draft audit report, where they actually suggested that this is an issue that the commission should consider finalizing the audit report. And it's something I probably in hindsight should have mentioned at the time we responded to the interim audit report. And there are definitely ambiguities with respect to how a rally does fit into the FEA requirements and the definitions.
Let's say a party has a rally.
Yep.
And it's a state Democratic Party rally. How do you pay for that?
I guess, before I answer that question, I guess we'd have to flesh out some facts about the rally. Because we'd have to determine whether or not, when the rally was, so you have whether or not it's within a 11 FEA window, whether or not there is voter registration activities happening, perhaps there's a voter registration table that's where they're actively getting folks to register or assisting people in voting. So there could be some other extraneous facts that we would need to know. So if it was purely a rally where there's no federal candidates mentioned and those things were going on, in that scenario, I could see it being qualifying as voter registration or get out the vote in that context. If it's purely and I guess in hindsight, we should have thought about this a little more. If it's purely a vote Democratic rally, no federal candidates mentioned or present, then I would posit that that's not necessarily a federal election activity. But it all boils down to whether or not, I think, if you look at the different types of federal election activity there are, the only possible category that it could fit into is generic. I don't believe it fits into get out the vote, and I understand I've been reviewing the notice of proposed rulemaking for the GOTV redefinition, and this of course is coming up in that context. But assuming obviously the rules that were in effect in 2006, I don't believe it fit into GOTV. So the only category it would fit into would be generic. And what it boils down to is whether or not it's a public communication. Because the definition of a generic communication is a public communication that promotes, supports, attacks, or opposes a political party without reference to a federal candidate. And I think that's something we just suggest you should consider, whether or not, the key here being whether or not it's public communication.
It's a bunch of people standing around, which is really what a rally is. Is that a public communication? It seems to be public communication is more more of a tangible medium of expression to it than people standing around, right?
I agree. I think that's, in terms of what is the concept of a public communication, at least I envision that it is some type of prepared communication, whether it be a newspaper ad, a mailing, a television communication, a radio ad. I don't personally believe that speaking to someone face-to-face, whether it be a person-to-person communication or a group of persons, should qualify as a public communication, that it doesn't meet any of the enumerated items, or is it a form of general political advertising, public political advertising?
If you're doing voter registration at the rally, I guess that's how you could use Levin to pay for part of that.
That's what I'm suggesting. Or if you are doing any other type of assistance to voting at the rally. And obviously, we'll have to see how that also fleshes out going forward in the NPRM that you're working on.
Relating to this case, how'd you pay for this rally?
These rallies were paid for with Levin funds and reported on Schedule 86, I believe is my recollection. So that's my recollection, at least.
And the issue is whether or not it should have been all federal and maybe a coordinated.
There's a suggestion. I actually don't remember specifically.
Okay.
That's my recollection. I may be wrong.
I'm just
trying
to flesh out all these other interesting issues you've raised.
I'll say this, though. I think that if we did pay for it all federal, we did report it as a federal election activity. I think it was on 30B if we did report it federal. I just don't remember at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question on rallies and one question on polls. I understand, anybody can, you're not responsible for the addressee on somebody else's mail. Somebody sends out a bill, you can't necessarily control where it goes. But some of the invoices appeared, had other language on them that suggested that they were very specifically federal. Like there was one, for example, for a Harold Ford Jr. campaign rally at Swingtime Golf Range on October 14th, 2006. Can you provide any other information as to why things were written on these invoices that suggested they were pretty clearly federal activity, but you're saying they're generic?
I cannot. I can only tell you that the exercise was the party staff at the time. We responded to the audit report to carefully review these invoices and to tell, to determine what they were, and that was how it was represented to me. I did not do any additional fact-finding personally. So I cannot add anything else to that.
Okay. And going back to the polls, there were a number of questions that, obviously are the ones that are most interesting from our perspective, that have a paragraph and then it says, does this make you more or less likely to vote for or against Ford or Corker? Were those actual ads, or were they proposed ads, or where did that text come from? Because they read like ads. You know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Well, typically, I don't know specifically the situation with the poll questions that you're talking about, but typically they would be potential ads, testing either a message that the campaign itself is considering using or a message that has been used or is anticipated to be used by the opposition. It's not likely that they would be actual ad messages. I mean, in some cases, ads are tested as, after they go out, either in focus groups or in polls. Have you heard so-and-so, did it make you more or less likely to vote? I don't think that's the case here, but that is done sometimes as well.
Just to give you a little bit more specifics, there's a number of these questions, but here's one. Harold Ford Jr., he's slick, he's smooth, but his record a little shaky. Ford is Tennessee's most liberal congressman. He campaigned in a church, but he took cash from Hollywood's top X-rated porn moguls. Ford talks values, but voted to recognize gay marriage, voted for taxpayer abortions 10 times, and wants to give the abortion pill to our school children. Strikes me as highly unlikely, but okay. Harold Ford, smooth talk, Hollywood values. Does this make you more likely to vote for Ford, less likely to vote? I mean, it's very specific. It sounds like it comes right out of an attack ad.
Yes, these were messages that have been put out by the the opposing candidate. Actually, it sounds like this is from multiple ads, from both from the opposition candidate, from some of the Republican Party committees, and so forth. And they're, again, they're testing the opposition's message, not,
see whether
not
it was
trying to persuade.
Right, yeah. I would assume that you would not want to persuade people of that message, but that you would be trying to test the, you know, whether this was resonating with voters.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly the purpose.
Okay. That's all I got. Thanks.
On a couple of these, when you went through them, I see the one invoice says Ford for Tennessee bottled water.
We actually conceded that one.
Okay.
That was the one we did concede. So.
But the very fact that you conceded it leads me to believe that there were some people out there who really recognized that some of these events had to be directed to promoting Ford.
Right. And that,
I mean, was it just this one isolated event? Because
that particular invoice was not related to the rallies that these other invoices were related to. That was kind of just one invoice that got grouped in with a bunch of other invoices, just because of the fact they were invoiced to the Ford campaign and were questioned by the auditors, which were then presented to the committee in the interim audit report, questioning whether or not they were legitimate party expenses. And we reviewed each one of those one at a time very carefully, and we did realize that that invoice was misplaced, and we did amend our reports.
Was there other invoices, just that one?
That was the only one that we determined was, in fact, a legitimate coordinated expenditure.
Okay. And that was the only coordination that you're aware of?
Correct. Right.
And why was this one particular one coordinated when there seems to be like such a pattern here?
Again,
we should assume
these invoices were bunched together because they were part of one particular event. They were just a group of invoices that were presented to the commission because of what was on them with respect to mentions of Harold Ford. So I don't want to imply that they were all from one event. They just were a group of invoices that we had to consider. It just so happens to be that that one invoice was, in fact, something that we should have reported as a coordinated expenditure.
Any questions from any commissioners? Office of General Counsel, are there any questions?
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. I just wanted to briefly revisit the issue about whether the polling activity is federal election activity. And you've said that it's really not logical to regard a poll as public communication. And I think you've also said that a poll is generally not understood to be a phone bank. But if you look at the statutory definition of phone bank, I think you'd have to agree that the activity here actually meets that literal definition, which really just goes to the number of calls and substantially similar questions within a 30-day period, et cetera. And how do you, I guess, square that, the fact that the literal statutory definition does seem to apply to this activity, or that this activity seems to meet the literal statutory definition of phone bank?
Well, again, it's not the term phone bank, while it has in terms of the number of calls and identical messages, it's understood to be a message that's intended to persuade the respondent to do something, whether it's a generic message to get out and vote, or to register to vote, or to vote for a particular candidate. It just does not make sense to interpret this based, or to assume that in enacting this definition. Again, the members of Congress, as Commissioner McGann pointed out, are very familiar with polls, would think of a phone bank covering a legitimate survey research exercise. It just is not how the term has ever been used.
I understand that, but I just wonder what the actual authority is for reading into that definition a requirement for persuasiveness of the message.
Again, it's just a question of context, the logical interpretation and meaning, where it's not, I think you can't assume that any message that's repeated is what was intended to be in the definition of a phone bank. Again, it doesn't make sense to assume, for example, as Mr. Reeve pointed out, discussed with Commissioner Weintraub, that this negative message about the candidate sponsoring the survey research is a phone bank that would be paid for by by that candidate.
I understand, and I appreciate your answer and the logic of it. I just think it would be helpful to all of us if there was some more specific authority on that question.
Was that a question, Mr. Chair?
I apologize. I was reading a declaration to Mr. Button.
If I follow up on that, but there's a MERV where that argument was advanced and that was not adopted by the commission, right? I mean, this is a rehash of what already happened in the DCCC MERV.
Our request for the hearing, so yes.
Right. This has already been decided, right? At least a legal issue. Well, there's a MERV, and the council's argument didn't receive 4 votes, so...
I'll represent that's a correct statement. MERV 5835, to be exact.
I have a question on them. We have these various invoices, and they're all directed to the Ford campaign. And yet, so we have to look at some other facts to dispute those. And all we really have is what I consider to be kind of a bare bones declaration from Mr. Button. It's on information and belief to start with. He then says that they were apparently invoiced. He didn't say he has personal knowledge of any of this. He said, is it my belief they were incorrectly invoiced? In my experience, it is not uncommon for vendors to be mistaken. Well, okay, we can all make mistakes. It is my belief the 11 invoices were incorrectly invoiced. So we don't have, it's on information and belief, and then there's nothing to indicate there was any personal knowledge of it. And then there's two affidavits I have. One clearly was signed by him, I would think, but this one does not appear to be. It seemed like it was stamped. Can you represent that he was actually signed this affidavit? Or declaration? If we have the representation, that would be certainly satisfactory.
I have every belief that he did. I don't have the original with me. I do not know if I forwarded it to the commission. It may have been faxed to me or emailed to me. But if you do want an original, I can certainly either confirm I sent it or find it. Somehow.
No, it was really just the way it was set out. It looked like a stamp on the way above the line. And I was just wondering, under the circumstances, we're really looking at the Button affidavit or declaration. So
I have every belief that he signed it personally. I would also posit that he also sent a memo to the auditors directly with the same information, which he also signed himself in July of 2007.
But is there anyone with personal knowledge who was actually there, to your knowledge, that verified this as far as you're
concerned?
This
was signed in Tennessee, so I was not physically present.
No, he was there at the rallies.
At the rally?
Yeah. Who actually can verify these things?
This affidavit and the response to the audit report were done in relative haste about a year after the campaign actually occurred. So it's... As you get, anyone who has responded to an allegation a year after it's occurred can tell you it's very difficult in the limited amount of time you have to do an intensive factual investigation. And especially in the context, and I'll just reiterate my point that I made in my opening statement, that we could have conceded all these as being campaign-related, and there would have been no negative consequence to the committee. But the committee, Mr. Button, who was responsible for helping us prepare this part of the audit report, was adamant that these were mistakes and felt very strongly about it. And in the amount of time were afforded to respond, and considering the lack of potential exposure, this is our presentation of our response.
I understand. Thank you very much. Other questions? Commissioner McGinn.
Following up on that, it sounds like at best or at worst, I guess, depending on your perspective, you have an issue of fact. You have an invoice that says one thing, you have a human being that says another, who's done an affidavit, representations of counsel. So if there's an issue of fact, it's tough to see an audit finding when there's a disputed fact. And I'm not saying it's disputed. I'm not disagreeing, because your presentation is consistent with my own experience. I think as a commissioner, I'm allowed to bring to the table my own common sense and world experiences. But let's assume, sort of put it in summary judgment terms, at best you have a genuine issue of material fact. So it's really tough to say as a matter of law that there's a finding of a violation. See what I'm saying?
Yes, and the reason we even brought this issue up in terms of the hearing today was because we were taken aback by the kind of dismissive, the approach, I should say, of the draft audit report, where it basically dismissed it just recommended that that you dismiss his declaration outright. And fairly, the general counsel's memo kind of said step back and, you know, you have to weigh these issues. But we were obviously very concerned with the way it was dismissed.
Sort of just ignored the issue of fact. I mean, let's assume it's a he said, she said, that was just ignored.
It seemed that way in draft, and that's why we came here today, and we just wanted to assure you that we had no motivation, desire to misrepresent this issue to the commission, and we wanted that to be clear.
One final point, back to the actual statute and the authority to read statutes a certain way, which of course an agency, by definition, gets to do that. Public communication, the telephone bank concept, it's telephone bank to the general public, right? So even if you have more than 500 calls, polls aren't to the general public. They're to a statistical sample. You don't just call the phone book when doing a poll, isn't that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. They're not.
You're looking for a certain demographic in a poll. You're not going to test. You're not going to test just your neighbors. You're going to do a cross section to get a statistical sample. You're not broadcasting to the general public.
Exactly. It's a very small. Normally, you know, very small percentage of the electorate that you're trying to characterize, just enough to meet the to represent a statistically valid sample. Typically done by random selection in the case of a random poll, which is the most common kind, and it's completely ineffective as a form of mass communication or public political advertising.
Anything further? Just to clarify a little bit on my end here, we're trying to find out the facts. We don't have to, at this proceeding, decide what the facts are. We're really looking at issues regarding reason to believe or probable cause. We're trying to figure this out. But in my mind, when you had a number of different invoices saying roughly the same thing from a bunch of different directions, then you look at what controverts that, and so I was looking really only at the declaration, which did not indicate personal knowledge and was pretty skimpy in my view in terms of contradicting these various certain events and what happened in these particular cases. So I just wanted to let you know that those were some of the things that were on my mind in terms of trying to figure out how to...
And I can only respond to that by saying that Mr. Button was the director of the program.
Right.
So he had personal... He may not have been at every rally, especially it's a state like Tennessee is a rather large state, so I suspect he wasn't traveling to all the rallies, but he did have knowledge of the type of program that they were running, and probably would have been he would have been responsible for procurement. So he would have been acutely aware of who the vendors were and what the intent of each expenditure was for.
Mr. Chairman, certainly the commission should satisfy itself that any testimony it considers is probative and reliable. We would have a concern as counsel for this and many other state parties about generally reliance by the commission on who an invoice is addressed to determine whether a particular expenditure was candidate specific or not. If the commission audited all the state parties, all the national parties in the last election cycle, you'd see all kinds of invoices.
Ideas, Mr. Sandler.
Let's
be careful what you wish for.
I say you would see all kinds of invoices that reference candidates. There would be office space rented, hundreds of offices rented by a state party in a state where the landlord addressed it to the Obama campaign. Even there's no question it was a state party that entered the lease and paid it. So this is very commonplace, and that's, I think, the concern that this particular state party had, and it would be a more general concern as well.
Thank you. Mr. Stoltz, do you have any questions to ask?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little for us on the events themselves. Are there advertising that went with it, invitations, announcements? What sort of materials were on display at the events?
Again, since the context of the question and the audit were the bills themselves, I did not spend at least in terms of preparing a response, because the entire program itself was not challenged. I did not spend any significant time doing any fact-finding on the event, so I really don't have an answer to that specific level of question.
Any further questions? If not, would you like to take a few minutes to close? Up to five?
We don't have a specific closing statement, but we thank you for agreeing to hear our concerns and for giving us our day. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Very helpful. Meeting's adjourned.